75 years ago, the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor during World War II, and the Onungan people were evacuated from the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands. They were taken to internment camps in southeast Alaska, where many died. Some of their villages were destroyed. Others were never resettled. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss the history and the impacts of the Aleut evacuation.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
During World War II, nearly 900 Onungan people were taken from their homes and resettled at abandoned canneries and mines in southeast Alaska. They were forced to live in unsanitary conditions without access to supplies needed for fishing or hunting. I'm Ann Hillman, and today my guests are Pat Pitrovelli, who is a descendant of one of the evacuees from Atka and was involved with the reparations process as an adult, and Rachel Mason, who's an anthropologist with the National Park Service and the program manager of the Aleutian World War II National Historic Area. Thank you both very much for being here. Later on, we'll also listen to some short recorded interviews with some of the survivors. And for all of our listeners, do you have any stories about the evacuation or questions? Call us at 550-8422 or 1-800-478-8255. I'm also taking emails at talk@alaskapublic.org. So thank you both for being here. I'd love to start with just a quick history. I realize this whole program is about history. But Rachel, can you briefly tell us why the U.S. government decided to remove the Onungan people from the Aleutian Islands?
Well, after the bombing of Dutch Harbor, it was ostensibly for their own protection. They wanted to remove them from harm's way was the idea. But it was a very ill-planned unthought out idea that they didn't even know where they were going to be taking people.
As in they rounded people up, put them on ships, and didn't even know where they were going?
Well, not exactly rounding them up, but telling them that they had to pack sometimes in as short as an hour, pack a single suitcase, and to get on the boat, and they didn't know where they were going.
And did the military know where they were going?
The first villages to be taken there were the people from the Pribilofs and from Atka. And I think, maybe Pat can tell more about where the Atkins went, but they already had places set up for them, or not really set up, but they knew where they were taking them, to Funter Bay in the case of the Pribilofians, and to Killisnoo in the case of Atka.
Yes, they knew that that's where they were going to take them because they picked up first. They used some kind of transporter to get the Atkin people, and they brought them to Unalaska. And then that bigger boat had already had the Pribilof people on there from St. Paul and St. George. And then the Atkin people got on that bigger boat, and then they went to southeast then, and they dropped off the Atkins first at Killisnoo. The ill-thought-out part was they dropped them off with a mattress for each person, a blanket, and a pillow. And the clothes on their back, and that was it. And they just dumped them there. And so, and then they took the Pribilofians to Funter Bay and just left them at Funter Bay. And then later, then the BIA came and brought supplies, minimal supplies, but the Atkin people, luckily the people of Angoon brought them food because Killisnoo's just very close to Angoon. There wasn't a bridge, or there still isn't a bridge, but they use skiffs to get from Killisnoo to Angoon, or they could, I think, walk it during low tide.
Okay.
But they could eventually BIA brought them food, some food, and some building materials. And then people proceeded to, because they were brought, the people of Atcombe, my mom, she was 12 years old then, and she was evacuated with her father and a brother and a sister. And they were older. She was the youngest in the family. But once they got supplies and other materials, because then my father renovated a little shed and that had one bedroom, and he tried to make it livable for the winter.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Pat, can you tell me the story of your mother and when they were evacuated, the memories that she told you?
Well, the BIA teacher, Mrs. McGee, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, for some reason they told people to always have a suitcase ready. And I don't know if they were just always waiting. But after the bombing of Dutch Harbor, the BIA teachers told them to go to their summer camps because it was June. And so they went to fish camps. And so they were all at the fish camps. But they didn't have their suitcase that they had had. Because you don't take a suitcase to fish camp. But, so they were at the fish camp, and they were there that day. And planes had been flying over, and they were helping fuel the there were American planes. But then they saw a Japanese plane that flew over, just a single one. And it bombed. It dropped a few bombs that didn't really hurt anything. But that night, they saw the village burning. And they didn't know if it was the Japanese that caused it to burn or the military. But then the next day, then they were told to go to the village, and they went to that transport ship that took them to first Nikolsky and then Dutch Harbor. And they found out later that they didn't burn all the houses. They just burned they left five houses that had running water.
So the military burned down the houses in Atka.
Yes, the Navy lieutenant that was in charge of the boat, he thought that he didn't want to leave shelter in case the Japanese invaded the island. He didn't want them to have shelter. And so he decided that it was a good idea to burn the village.
And Rachel, did this happen in other villages as well? Were they burned?
They weren't burned. There was damage while they were gone because of the military rifling through them or taking things out of their houses. But Atka was unique in that. The other villages, there was no plan for where to take them in Southeast Alaska. And so the first for Unalaska and the villages in that region, the smaller villages, they were taken to the Wrangell Institute, which was a boarding school, a native boarding school in Wrangell. And so they, for a few weeks, they camped there in tents outside, or some of them were able to stay in the dorms because the students weren't there in the summer. But eventually, the Unalaska people were taken to Burnett Inlet, which was a dilapidated former cannery, and the smallest villages, Borka, Kashiga, Makushin, Akutan, and Nikolsky, they were taken to Ward Cove, which is a CCC camp. It had been built a Depression era CCC work, and it was about 8 miles outside of Ketchikan.
Okay. And all the smaller villages on Unalaska Island, did the boat go by each individual village and say, okay, everybody, it's time to go?
They stopped and picked them up, and they stopped by the sheep ranch at Chernovsky, and where there were a few people working, and picked them up.
And did they pick up everybody who was living in the villages, or
Yes, yes. Even in the case of McCutcheon, even the non-native storekeeper came. That family took off while they were in Wrangell, and they left the group and actually settled in Wrangell.
Oh. For Unalaska, which was a larger community at that point, the Aleuts were evacuated. Were the non-Aleuts also evacuated?
No. And in Unalaska, there was the largest non-native population and several families that where the one parent was white and the other was native. And in those families, the white people were left behind and stayed in the community, and the native people were taken to Southeast Alaska.
Why? So if ostensibly the evacuation happened because they were trying to protect civilians and protect people from the Japanese and from the military.
Yeah.
Why is it that the white people were not taken?
Well, I think it is a paternalistic idea.
Yeah, I would say it was a paternalistic idea. And I think the woman and children, the white woman and children, were told to leave also. It was just the white men that got to stay behind. But they evacuated all the Aleuts. And it has to do with that idea of the government treated with the Bureau of Indian Affairs as kind of maybe their trust responsibility. They felt that it was their role to protect the Aleuts. Mm-hmm. And so even though because of the wartime and the lack of planning, that they just dropped them off at these abandoned camps and then left them without resources, you know, for 2 years. But what happened I never believed my mother when she would tell me this story. And
wait, why wouldn't you?
Well, after she, you know, was at the camp, first she went to a boarding school, and then she went to Haskell Institute, and then came back and married an Army GI. And so I grew up an Army brat. And so as I, you know, lived on the Army bases and stuff, and I just always my country first. And I just never would believe the government would treat people that way, you know, that they would, you know, just tell them what to do and then drop them off with nothing. And then, you know, just the stories that I would hear about how people were treated. So I just wouldn't believe her. And we were traveling around the lower 48. And so she was the only person that told me that story. And no one else had heard about that story. You know, I'd never heard anything about it. But then my father retired and we moved back to Anchorage in 69 and met the other relatives from Atka. And they said, oh, yes, your mother is telling the truth, you know. And so I finally believed her. And eventually I ended up working on a lot of projects, helping to research and document and listen to testimony of elders and read some of the archives about how the government did do this. As to why they did it, Dean Kohlhoff wrote an excellent book, When the Wind Was a River, and whenever he'd talk about it, he'd always talk about the word administrative convenience. And it's a concept that, you know, just, yes, it's a time of war, and they were just doing something that was expeditious, and they didn't go out of their way to do something correct. They just did it what was convenient. So it's a term that I came to appreciate with his excellent research of administrative convenience is a concept that's hard to understand, but it's prevalent throughout the whole story of the evacuation and the repatriation of people back to the islands later.
Mm-hmm. Just one point that there were a couple of Aleut men who stayed on Alaska because they had jobs working for the military or doing something. So that fits with the idea that it was a paternalistic idea of protecting the women and children and those who needed to be protected.
Pat, in your interviews with evacuees as they were years later when they were an adult, did they react to that? How did they feel about this paternalism?
Well, people just didn't understand why it happened. And I was interviewing people in like 1980. So I was interviewing people that were a lot of them were children during that time or young adults. And they were just more dealing with because they just got caught up in the evacuation. There was one lady that was just a young adult the ones that would have been young adults, and they just kind of went with the flow. I think it's time of war. You hear there's military boats out there, and they were just bewildered mainly about what happened, and the outrage came later.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go to the phones right now. We have Wendy from Juneau on the line. Wendy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the subject matter. I was born and raised in Juneau, but spent about 3 years in an Alaska Dutch harbor. And my mother is Japanese and was interned at Minidoka in Idaho. She lived in Seattle and was interned there. But I've had the privilege of going to some Minidoka reunions or with her. And one of my big takeaways in one of the classes was the concept of euphemisms, and which is basically an understated word. And the point I'd like to make is that what happened to the Aleuts and the Japanese was actually not really evacuation or relocation or assembly centers. They were concentration camps. And what happened to the Jews in Germany were not concentration camps. Those were death camps and human experimentation camps. And the importance of using these words correctly is that apparently it had a lot to do with the formal apology and the money that was offered to the Japanese and not enough to the Aleuts. But it was important to use the correct words to help define what happened and what that amount was. And anyways, it was an atrocity, and I'm so appreciative of you folks having this conversation, and applaud the speakers, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you for calling in. Pat, Wendy's comments were talking a lot about during the reparations, the language used during the reparations process, and whether or not really the terms relocation and internment camps are the appropriate terms versus things like concentration camps.
Well, it's true that internment camps were where the Japanese were taken, the Japanese Americans. And so they were forced, they were in internment camps, and there were fences around them, and they were forced to be there unless they did military service. And but in Aleuts, it was the relocation where they were put there. And the way they were put in those camps, they were just told, if you leave those camps, then you don't get to go home. Because I'd always ask my mom, well, why did you stay in those camps? And the government told us if we left those camps, we couldn't go home. But, you know, technically, I was reading my mom's account just to refresh my memory, and my grandfather did leave and go to Juneau for a little while and worked to earn money, but then he went back to be with the village when they went back to Atka. So they weren't completely forced to be there, but they were told to stay together. Otherwise, the government wouldn't bring them back to their home villages, which happened to some of the smaller communities because they weren't able to resettle their villages.
I'd like to go to a piece of audio now. You Pat, earlier you mentioned that a lot of the folks who went there when they were young didn't really know what was going on, and I spoke with Haritina Krukoff, who's 90 now, but when she was evacuated at 16 from St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs, her recollections of that time were actually very positive, which I thought was different than other accounts I had heard. And also her daughter said that she heard different things growing up as well. So here's a couple quick excerpts from my interview with Haritina Krukoff.
I was happy when they took us out of there so I can see something. You know, I didn't think nothing much about it, so when we moved out of there.
You were
You were happy to go?
Yeah. Just to see what it's like outside, you know. I've never been out of the island, you know. I was all excited when I see. The first thing I said was, oh, trees. I was happy. Because I've seen them in the movies and all that, and I never see trees before. You know, I got all excited when I see trees. All of us young kids. Yeah, all of us were all excited. My brothers and my cousins, and my friends. Oh, I live with my grandparents.
Oh.
Yeah. We moved there, and we got little rooms, you know, small little rooms. And my grandpa got one with the other room. So we have a room, kitchen and living bedroom anyway. And my grandpa made bunks, a couple of them, for us.
For sleeping?
Yeah. So I used to sleep on a bunk. My grandpa fixed those, kitchen wire. Yeah, he was smart. He's a carpenter. We used to go walk all the way out to the, what they call it, Punter Bay, by the beach. I used to sit around there. I don't even know how to swim, you know. And my friend tried to swim, Alice. She got scratched all over. And I tried too, and my feet got scratched too. Dumb. Didn't even know to swim either. I got married in Punter Bay. We had priest. We have little church. Yeah. Oh yeah, we had big party in that bunkhouse, they call it. Big room. Yeah, my grandpa cooked. He was a cook. I was just a teenager, and I thought I was in love, so. I think I was. I really like him, you know. And I had 7 children from him.
So it was interesting. So after Tina told all of those stories and her daughter prompted her a bit more, she did say, well, that her cousin had died and her auntie had died and that other kids were sick a lot, but she was never sick. And her daughter said that when she was younger, she heard more negative things about what happened at the camps. And she was really surprised listening to this conversation where her mom was really just focusing on the positive. Do either of you have reactions to that?
Yeah. It's interesting that was the child's point of view. And I think that's pretty common in the stories that come out of it, that the children saw it more as a great adventure. But the elders were, the trees were really sinister to them. And not something exciting that you would see because it was a great adventure. So I think that's pretty common.
Yeah, and well, even the trees. At first, my mom says when they landed at Killisnoo and they got off the boat, she was just so happy to be off the boat because to be that long from Unalaska to there was just a long voyage. And
how long was it?
It was, I think, 10 days or so or something mm-hmm. like that. It was quite a long, I'm not sure, but it mm-hmm. took a while. And then they didn't have enough to eat, but she remembers smelling the roses. You know, that was the first thing because it was June. And then seeing the trees. But then she said eventually she got so that she was afraid of the trees. And she kind of taught me that, you know, even though I didn't grow up in the Aleutians, she instilled in me that dislike of trees because so, there's no trees in the Aleutians at all. And it was very foreign to go, well, the men had to learn once they were able to work in the canneries and get money for guns and fishing gear. They knew what to do on the ocean. They with the lumber the BIA gave them, they built dories and they went fishing. But then to go hunting in the woods was very different, you know, instead mm-hmm. of hunting with treeless. Well, they would have hunted for reindeer or seals and sea lions before.
So it's a very...
To look for deer in the woods was yeah. different.
Yeah. And the people at Ward Lake were in a unique situation because they were outside of Ketchikan, a major city. And, well, not city, but it was a big town. And some of them were able to get jobs in Ketchikan. There was a bus that was in the 8 miles, a man named Mr. Wacker started a bus service running back and forth so that they wouldn't have to walk the 8 miles back and forth to Ketchikan.
Wow. Yeah, Tina was telling me about how she had to go to Juneau to get her marriage license, and how people would go kind of back and forth and work mm-hmm. there. And she was also telling me about how people from other villages would, like from local villages, would come and teach them how to hunt and live in the Southeast. So there was connections.
Yeah.
I'd like to take another caller. Dennis from Kodiak is on the line. Dennis, thanks for calling.
Greetings from Kodiak. Great subject. I was just cooking in the kitchen listening to your show, and that caller that called in about 8 or 9 minutes ago pointing out that some of those things weren't so pretty. The late Senator Fred Zaroff, who was a dear friend, his family adopted me when I moved here in 95. After he parted, I was given some things in remembrance of him, and two of those things are documentaries that he had everything to do with in regards of your topic. And in those documentaries, they show the military Jeep parked in somebody's living room, you know, out on the chain. And anyway, I don't know if any of your guests today are familiar with Fred's work in regard to this subject, but I guess my bottom line hopes is that anybody listening who is tempted to contribute to this show, I'm hoping that they do so. So thank you. What a great listening thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling. And I will reach out to other listeners. If you would like to call and share stories that you heard from elders, stories that you experienced yourself, please do call. The number is 1-800-478-8255, or you can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. If you're here in Anchorage, the number is 550-8255.
With the idea of money to make the story known, I know that Patrick Pletnikoff, when he was the head of APIA, he started doing research just because he was upset about the Atuans, because the Atuans weren't part of the land claims, because, well, the way a typical village was, because they were forced to move to Atka after the war, so they couldn't claim the island that they lived on. And so he started doing gathering information, and with all that other activity, then with the wartime relocation and internment of civilians, then other people got the Aleuts in there, and eventually APIA needed money to help fund the research, and they hired an attorney, and they worked with Lydia Black, and they put together 8 volumes of evidence that they submitted to the Wartime Relocation Internment Commission that documented it and helped with, you know, the government restitution that was eventually there. And then, of course, those making of those documentaries. And I'm sure people lobbied the state legislature to get funds to gather up all that information and to help people prepare testimony. So that might be some of that Fred Zaroff activities that he would have heard when APIA would have went there asking for money. Well, APIA, the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, mm-hmm. that would have carried out that work. And also the Aleut Corporation, with my mom when she was a president, she helped spearhead those activities.
Spearhead the activities of gathering evidence and information and...
And trying to get money back, yeah, for the, well, restitution or just, yes, mm-hmm. to get the government to get some restitution.
Let's go to Eddie from Homer, who is on the line. Eddie, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good day.
Good day.
I first want to extend my full-hearted support and blessings to all the descendants of families who had to deal with the concentration camp environments that they were subjected to, because I agree with the previous caller, that's what they were focused to be. When we speak about the terms of the period, that it was a paternalistic and or bureaucratic convenience, we now have to see it with more modern eyes to realize that it was a racist and politically convenient and or economically convenient approach to what needed to be done by our government. The homes that were destroyed in some cases were done by our side, by our U.S. troops, the looting that went on, and so on. And I want to share that hopefully your program and your efforts will raise the bar to this not happening again, because I feel that as people gather in fear and circle their panic wagons, the possibility of this happening in our country again could be. And hopefully we will learn from our brothers and sisters in the Aleutians to say, no, it's not going to happen again. Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie, for calling.
I can respond to that by telling about an event that I'm just coming off of. It was a three-day event that was commemorating the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Dutch Harbor and Aleut evacuation. So we had a real challenge before us to honor both the military experience and the experience of Aleut evacuation, because we invited evacuees back, and we had 40 evacuees altogether, including 9 who were living in Unalaska already, plus 8 veterans of the war. And intertwining those two stories, we wanted it to be an experience of mutual understanding, and I think we really pulled it off. There was at a storytelling event, one of the veterans got up and said, I never understood why there weren't any Native residents in the communities. And they didn't know what had happened to the inhabitants. And there were also stories of the bad things that happened because of the military, of looting and destroying items in houses and churches. But it was the people listened to each other, and they told stories to each other, and it was really a remarkable event.
And maybe through things like that, we can stop things like this happening again. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk of Alaska for more conversation about the Aleut evacuation. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing the Aleut evacuation during World War II. If you'd like to join the conversation, share memories, ask questions, you can call us at 1-800-478-8255 or here in Anchorage, 550-8422. We're also taking emails at talk@alaskapublic.org. Pat from Kodiak, you're on the line. Thank you for calling. Pat, are you still there?
Hi. Yeah, this is Pat Holmes.
Hi.
Kodiak. Am I on?
Yes, you are. Welcome to the program.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm a little deaf. I just have been to Atka and Attu and out west many times since 63 and had the real pleasure working 3 summers in Atka and listening to the stories of the Nick Nevesroff and Spike and Taddy, and I remember just treasure one day walking through the village where Pat's mom was outside. She patted a board on the porch and said, sit down, let me tell you stories. And incredible stories of those folks and what they went through. And I recall one thing that Nick Goldoff mentioned, and it's been so long, but I think when the Atuan folks were on the way on the boat and coming back to Atka, and maybe Pat will correct me, but I think they kind of expected they'd be going home to Attu, and they were told, no, this is the last stop. You get off here or go back. And I just thought that was kind of bad form, because the BIA had supported all those little villages before. And I think after the land claim settlement, I'm just so glad that they were able to get some restitution. But that's just such a magnificent place if you go into that village, because you just feel a spiritual closeness, and can only feel a little bit of the pain of the people that could never go back. So with that, I'll be quiet and listen to Pat a bit.
Thank you for calling.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that the Atuans thought they could go back, but I think the adults would have known that they had a choice of either going to Atka or elsewhere. And some people absolutely did not want to relocate to Atka. They would want to live elsewhere, because kind of like your nearest neighbor, you're not always the friendliest with. But luckily, the people who did get to go to Atka, the Atuan families that went there, they settled in and became part of the community. And they were rebuilding the houses anyway, so they just built more houses for the Atuans. But it is a shame the way – well, we always thought that BIA told people that the military said they couldn't relocate in those smaller places. That's what we always understood, you know, in the village. But then when Dean Kohlhoff's research came out, it wasn't the military that said that. It was just the administrative convenience. And BIA and the post office didn't want to deliver mail to those communities. And so they just suggested maybe you need to consolidate the communities. And that's why they weren't, at least that's one some of the reasons those villages weren't resettled after the war.
There were a couple of brave attempts to resettle them, and most notably in Borka, where Andrew McCushion, the leader, went on his own, and 20 other people also went, and they managed to live there for several years, but it was without government support or funding. It was impossible to make it out there. And in another village, Kashiga, a couple of men, bachelors, or actually one was a widower, they resettled and lived there on their own for several years before they, for health reasons, had to come back to Unalaska.
And so the people who couldn't go back to the smaller villages on Unalaska Island ended up in the town of Unalaska.
Well, some of them were dropped off at Akutan, and which I mean, that was the idea, similar to what happened to the Atuans, that they were taken to another village and left there. And others moved to Unalaska after the war. But none of those three villages of Kashiga, McCushion, and Borka were resettled ever again.
You, a few years back, led a trip taking people back to the original village sites. Tell me a little bit about that trip. Why did you lead it, and what were you hoping to come from it?
Well, it was a project that had started. It was the Lost Villages Project. It had started as an oral history project that Ray Hudson had interviewed some of the elders back in 2004. And when the National Park Service started... actually, it was Patty Gregory's idea, because her father was from McCushion. Mm-hmm. She suggested, why don't we make return trips to the villages? And so it, with some of the elderly survivors and their descendants, the first year was McCushion. And we wanted to go to both McCushion and Kashiga, but the weather turned us back from Kashiga. But we did go to McCushion. Nick Lukianoff showed us where to plant a cross, because we planted a cross at the site of the former church.
Was anything left of the church? Anything left of the village at all?
There was an old cross there, a weather-beaten cross, but the building was gone. But he showed us how to place the new cross at the place. And we went on the Tekla, the Fish and Wildlife Research Vessel, and the captain and crew were very helpful in transferring the elderly to land, and then even digging the place to plant the cross, and they couldn't have been better. And then the next year we went to both Kashiga and Borka, and similarly it was on the Tekla. At each place we planted a cross, and they and sang Memory Eternal in honor of the village.
And did people share a lot of stories about what the villages were like?
There was a map of Kashiga that the former residents showed where their houses had been, and made corrections to the map in each of them we mapped the village and asked the surviving residents to talk about their where their house was and what they remembered about it. So that each of them had many stories about what life was like, what they remembered of the village. And one man, George Gordeyev, also he just wanted to look at the coast as we walked on. I mean, to remember the special the places that he remembered. And he was a former boat captain, and he was also the only one that wasn't seasick when we were on our way to McCushion.
Wow. I'd like to jump to the phones now. We have Caroline from Anchorage calling. Caroline, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Good morning. I was out in Accutan and Nikolsky and along that area in the early 80s. And one of the things I thought about, because I heard about the destruction of the icons and the theft. And in Accutan, I was told there had been folks that had gardens which were destroyed. So, and also the rifles or anything that was left, those were taken. But I wondered if the military, and they would be the ones that would have the responsibility, they know who all the soldiers were that were out there, if they would try and contact family members of those soldiers and just see if there is any knowledge that they have, or if especially if there were any items that were left to them from anyone that may have taken them. I think that would be a certainly something that they should do, and maybe there are so many ways to do reparations, and I think that the Army should reach out and do every single thing they can, or Navy, whichever ones were there.
Thank you. Oh, Pat.
Well, I got to go. I attended the 50th anniversary of the bombing with my mom, and my mom met soldiers there, and some that were at Atka during the thing. And one of the soldiers came up to her, and he felt guilty because he did take their family Bible. And I don't know what happened to it, but it must have got destroyed. And he gave her another Bible to replace it. But he did have a conscience. And I guess because my father was a military guy, and when he was in France and in World War II, his favorite, when he didn't talk about the bad parts, but he talked about how when they were going through the French countryside and they stole the cow, and then they sold it back to the farmer. And so then you think, okay, these are, you know, young men, you know, 19, 20, 21, and they're just with nothing better to do, and he'd love telling that story. But then when you think, when you're the receiving end of those activities, then you have a different viewpoint. And those young men, there were, you know, thousands of soldiers there with nothing to do, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were just left there for a winter or a year, and they had nothing to do. And I mean, it's not an excuse, but it just happened.
You were part of the interviews back in the 80s with a lot of people when discussing reparations. Can you tell us a little bit more about that process and what sort of information you're looking for and what sort of response people were hoping to get?
Well, people just wanted, for one, like my mother, for the story to be known, because she was tired of me not believing her, and other people that had not heard about the story. So they wanted the story to be known just so it wouldn't happen again. And then with the restitution, it was structured differently between Aleuts and Japanese Americans. The Japanese Americans got $20,000 for each individual, and the Aleuts only got $12,000. But the Aleuts also got a $5 million fund for cultural purposes, and then a fund to restore the churches. And that was about $1 million. I worked with Barbara Sweetland Smith on documenting the destruction that happened to the churches, and it turns out there was like $4 million, but there was an accurate inventory, and a foundation was set up to help repair the churches and try to make them, and people contributed to that foundation, and so the Ascension Cathedral in Unalaska was restored, and the Atka Church was completely rebuilt, and other church and I think they're going down the list is to make other repairs of the churches.
Does that seem like enough to you?
I think the survivors were happy with it, because with the restitution, the foundation does help with cultural activities, and it gives grants to culture camps, and it gives payments to the survivors. As far as, I mean, is it enough to me? I mean, well, war is war, and things happen. Ideally, enough would be that things aren't done for administrative convenience again. That would be enough for me, but I don't know if that could be possible.
All right. We are going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back with some more calls and another quick interview.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Their online, evening, and campus-based courses make education accessible and will fit into any busy schedule. Be motivated by a devoted faculty and creative, independent-minded students. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. Moving life ahead with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing the Aleut evacuation. And before we go on with the conversation, I'd like to jump to another short interview with another individual who had been evacuated. It's Harriet Hope. She was in Unalaska during the bombing on June 3rd, 1942, and was soon relocated with her family. She shared some of her memories with Laura Craigle and Zoe Sobel at KUCB.
Now, once they took us down to the internment camps, we were there for 4 years. Of course, we were forced to leave with barely more than the clothes on our backs, which led us to believe that we'd only be gone a short time. You know, and they never would tell us where we were going, and never knew from day to day when we'd get any information on when we could go home. First, they dropped us off at Wrangell Institute, which is a Native boarding school, and they separated all of the villages to different areas in Southeast. And every one of them were burnt-out, abandoned canneries. And they just dropped us off there, and we just was left to fend for ourselves. It was like going to another planet. We had no plumbing, no electricity, no grocery store. We had none of the elements that would be normal today. We had eye infections. We had measles. We had a horrible flu that came through. The whole village would be sick. We found out that the United States had a prisoner of war camp about 20 miles from us. And they had everything. They had electricity, running water, they had food, they had everything they needed. And that just started my anger all over again. I was just hoping that somebody would see this and not ever let it happen to another group of people. It should just be mentioned. I wouldn't want to see it blown up or anything, but it should be casually as kids learn other history, you know, like slavery and things like that.
Do either of you have reactions to Harriet's recollections?
Well, it seems like her feelings are what my mom would have felt, too. She definitely would not want it to happen again. And then that outrage, you know, that's why she spent a lot of time advocating for the restitution and speaking up and sharing her experiences about what happened during the war.
Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to Heratina Krukoff, she focused on the positive for most of the interview, but at the very end, she was like, $1,200, that's nothing, because so many people were sick and died. So it was interesting at the end, sort of, her anger did come out. Rachel, you've interviewed a lot of people.
I've heard of other people talk about that German prisoner of war camp, too, that it was like a luxury hotel compared to Burnett Inlet. And they actually had some of the Allied men work on building the prisoner of war camp. And that's when they noticed how much better it was.
Wow. I'd like to take another caller. This is Mike from Anchorage. Mike, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. This is a great program. I'm really appreciative of KSK for all you do.
Thanks.
I do want to raise one question. There's nothing to excuse the treatment of the Aleutian Islanders by the American government, and also the disrespect that American soldiers might have shown or did show to their property and so on. But I also would like to raise the issue of the context of the time, and that the American government may have felt they had good reason for removing the people from the Aleutian Islands in light of the fact that the Japanese had also taken Atuans to Japan and put them in slave labor, and that more than half of them died from disease and starvation while they were there. And, you know, it's just, I think the context of history is important, as, you know, to mention as well. So anyway, that's really my point. And again, it's not to excuse any kind of behavior, but my concern would be that it might be a context to try to accuse a government of just wanting to seize the islands and the property from them. Mm-hmm. Which they could have already done if they had wanted to do that. So, anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thank you for calling.
And I agree the Aleuts that from Attu that went to Japan did have the 50% fatality, and the Aleuts that went to Southeast had about a 10% fatality. So, you know, thankfully, not so many people died. But the idea of seizing property, and I know the lawyer that worked in this case, he pointed out that when the government does seize it, usually they're paid fair compensation. And the Aleuts really, I mean, that was a process that only worked out after the wartime relocation and internment of civilians. You know, that the settlement was an afterthought in 1980, you know, not when it was happening. But yes, in the context of war, things happen, and everyone was afraid of war. You know, I mean, people were, like, when they didn't have food in Angoon and stuff, is a lot of people were being rationed in World War II. It was wartime, and things were happening. My mom was very much aware of the wartime aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling, Mike. We have another person on the line, Craig from Fritz Creek. Craig, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'd like to, if I can, my father, when he was in high school, crewed, at least during the summer times, on some of the supply boats that went to both Gustavus, the POW camp, and to the various, whatever you want to call them, relocation camps for the Aleuts and so on in through Southeast Alaska. And he would practically cry when he talked about going to Thunder Bay and places like that and seeing how poorly the people were treated, and the fact that the guys, the POW camp, always got first choice of all the stuff, and everything else was kind of an afterthought for the people through the in the relocation camps.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that memory.
Yeah, it was, when he talked about it, it was, he felt it was pretty rough. He was a teenager at the time, and he said he'd come in, and here would be these kids and adults dressed in rags practically, and the homes. Here they are. These are people that are transplanted to a place that they had no idea what they were dealing with. And as the lady said earlier here, these were burned out, wrecked out cannery camps that there was nothing being done really to help the people relocate. You know, the idea might have been a good idea, but there was no follow through at all.
One of the things that comes out again and again in looking at the all those camps had very poor sanitary conditions. And Charles Mobley he surveyed all of them to each one of the locations to see if they had the integrity to be on the National Historic Register. And what he found was that there were one or two outhouses for you know, everybody that was there in each one of the places. There was very poor sanitation.
So like one or two outhouses for a couple hundred people.
Right, right. Or in the case of Ward Cove, he saw when he was there in, what was it, 2008, there was a pump there that he was pretty sure was on the site of the single outhouse that had serviced the whole camp.
Like the water pump?
Yeah, the water pump that's there now.
I mean, how were people getting water?
I've seen pictures of pumps that they were getting water from, but there wasn't any running water that I know. Maybe,
well,
you know.
It killed us new. I think they had small ponds, but they had to boil the water always before they drank it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both very much for being here. Today on Talk of Alaska, we're discussing the Aleut evacuation. My guests were Rachel Mason, who is the program manager of the Aleutian World War II National Historic Area, and Pat Picciavelli, who is a descendant of one of the evacuees from Atka and also involved in the reparations process. Thank you to all of our callers. This has been Talk of Alaska on Alaska Public Radio Network.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.